With Kamui back in the game, it's time to seal away a sword or two and get some answers out of Hinoto.
We are Lucy and Robin, and we'll be your guides through Clamp's Wonderland.
How's it going, Robin?
The world is still pretty weird and exploding, and we can definitely say that every episode for a lot of episodes for this year.
Pretty much.
And I don't mind having that time capsule.
Yeah, we're sorry if it gets a little repetitive for people, especially in the way future, who are hopefully listening to this. Hello, future people!
Oh my goodness, I really want to think that there's people in the future. But for a couple personal updates here, like, my book is done.
Yay.
And turned in. Lucy's term is done.
Yay.
And now we're just sort of floating in space.
Yeah.
But we're trying to focus on writing novels this year and spending time with the people that we're safe to have contact with and working on this podcast, which has been really important. Also working on our other podcast that has to do with our writing.
Yeah, we haven't mentioned it in a while, but our writing podcast, Write For Me, Write For You, now has its own Twitter account and its own, you know, main feed, because the first episode went up in this one and on our Patreon. But it's got its whole own space now, and we host, like, writing nights on Twitter every Wednesday. And it's been a lot of fun, and it's really helping me, like, stay on top of my writing.
Yeah, I don't know, making the podcast that we're making, and, of course, reading Clamp in order to discuss it, doing research for that, and, like, actually writing in order to do the writing podcast, it's been really helping keep me a little more grounded. I mean, it isn't revolutionary action, and it's not protecting my friends, which are things that are really important, but this is, like, kind of helping keep me sane while I am working towards those things, because those things feel so insurmountable, especially when we're just totally floored by depression and ennui. And horror, and I feel like these things have really given me a sense of normal that I really appreciate.
Yeah, it's been nice to have, because we have, like, a weekly recording date, basically, where we're recording either this or the other one or a bonus or something. We're almost always recording something, sometimes many things in one day.
Yeah.
And it's been nice to have that grounding, you know, weekly check-in time, and and it's all been, like you said, it's not actively working towards some of the goals that we want to help in the world, but it helps me, like, kind of refresh so that I can work towards those goals, and
yeah, helps me be a person.
Yeah, and maybe add a little, you know, enjoyment to some of the people who are also either working hard for those goals or more affected by the, you know, injustices than we are. So I like to think we're doing a little bit to help make other people have a good day.
Yeah, so thank you for everybody who's listening and who's coming along with us on this, because, hey, you know, you're part of it for us, too. Like, just knowing that anybody is there to listen, just knowing that, like, we could do anything to make somebody's day a little better, like, oh my goodness, it means a lot.
Yeah, and knowing we can open Twitter and see lots of wonderful people, you know, talking about various things in our feed is just, it helps make the world feel less horrible.
Yeah. All right, so that's a funny thing to talk about. It's funny to talk about making the world feel less horrible when we are literally talking about, like, this super apocalyptic manga, but we are going to continue to talk about that. And, I mean, again, content trigger warning stuff here, like, there is gore in this. Like, there's quite a bit of it, and it's pretty stressful. And definitely family member loss, it comes up in this a lot too. So if you need a moment, you don't need to go on this journey today. You can go on it when you're feeling better about
yep.
it. Okay, so volume 10 was released in September of 1997, so that is actually the same year as the previous volume, volume 9, so we are back on track, which is great. The English volume was released, I mean, in the early 2000s, of course, and it is titled Fugue. Both the Japanese and English editions featured an illustration of Kakyo in a white kimono seated on the branch of a magnolia tree. The Japanese volume's front flap features him on the tarot card as well, and he is the Wheel of Fortune, with the Hebrew letter Nun. We missed a few episodes of, like, updating the Clamp timeline here, but by this point, Rig Veda has ended, Rareth has also had its run and exploded in popularity and changed everything for them and set them on the path to create Cardcaptor Sakura, which was launched in 96. The X movie had been released in 96. The Clamp School anime came out in 97. They were also releasing periodic installments of Wish and Clover. Clamp's popularity had gone from being a very niche, tight-knit fan community stemming from doujinshi conventions to all across their industry and related industries. Because remember, Rareth got a video game, and the X movie did too, I think. But also, like, their popularity has become international at this point. Rareth began its serialization in Animerica in 1997.
That's so crazy. So,
not only international, but reaching our shores, yeah.
Yeah, so weird.
The days of them just being four women stuck in a tiny apartment sleeping under their desks are far behind.
Yeah, it is wild to think about that. Like, as it's actually getting into things I'm starting to remember, you know, in reality.
Yeah, yeah, and we're sort of into, like, our timeline a little bit. It's nuts.
Yeah. So we begin this volume with the Clamp Campus Detectives, and I'm sorry, I can't not call them that.
I think that's fair. There will always be the Clamp Campus Detectives in our hearts, no matter how big they get.
They really will. So they take the Kamui crew to the center of campus, right at the very heart of the pentagram, to a fancy fountain. And Nokoru, who really does all of the talking for the Clamp Boys, I don't think that Akita or Soul ever really say anything.
Yeah, I don't remember them doing it.
If they did, it was like when they were introduced back a couple volumes ago. But they're not.
Yeah.
They are not very necessary to the, like, momentum here. So Nokoru tells Kamui to walk into the center of the fountain and put his hand on the totally inappropriate logo of their school. It's a, you know, the cute pufferfish, and it is way cuter than all of the blood and gore in this volume deserves. So
the characters do all kind of note that, by the way.
Yeah.
Like, there's a moment, so not just like, I love it.
Yeah, it's a very cute and kind of much needed lighthearted moment, so maybe it was very appropriate after all. Anyway, it's a device that will only react to Kamui, so he has to be the one to do it. And sure enough, as he wades out there, like literally wades, like he's just in the water with his sneakers getting super wet. I was like, oh no. I had a mom moment of being like, honey, roll up your panty things. So he wades out there and places his hand on, you know, the pufferfish. And the pool around the fountain opens up to reveal a hopefully waterproof staircase.
Did this remind you of Utena?
Yeah.
It hit me right in the Utena region of my brain, which is definitely a whole region of my brain. I'm sure you have an Utena region also.
Oh yes, it's vast.
Also, Yuzuriha describes it as being like a super robot launching bay, and that made me love her even more.
It's also just a really well-drawn scene. Like, you get this really cool shot from, like, inside the staircase as the the parts are opening up, where you can kind of see Kamui. It's very cool.
Yeah, it's got lots of good drama.
Mm-hmm. So they follow the staircase down to a room full of crazy magic tech, which kind of has a beam of light highlighting a device in the center that sort of resembles an upside-down claw hand from a claw machine, but is clearly where he's supposed to put the sacred sword. And this area really reminded me of, like, Reg Veda with all of the, like, I don't know, just something about, like, the walls and the tech and stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of Giger-esque. It has like an organic look, which is distinctive somewhat from Beast. I'm not sure, like, I don't know whether they're trying to make you feel like those are connected or not, because they both are just very heavily reliant on cables that have an almost like forest-like root structure kind of look. But it is a little less, it's definitely not as like grotesque as Beast is.
Yeah, I would say that the stuff here feels a little bit more ornate and a little more Art Nouveau, whereas the Beast stuff feels a little bit more cyberpunk.
Definitely.
Yeah. So Nokoru explains that this area was built by the former chairman when she promised Kamui's mother that she'd protect the sword. And we can remember the chairman from the Clamp Campus era stuff when she would appear as a mysterious woman in a kimono whose face was usually at least partially, if not completely, obscured. And she would usually kind of just be giving them instructions and often, like, hiding in the shadows or, like, you know, convenient
behind
shadows cutting off her head.
Yeah. I think she's Nokoru's aunt, right?
Yeah, I believe she is.
Okay, so Speaking of swords, because we are still speaking of this sword, the other one, you remember, the one Nataku stole from the Togakushi Shrine oh so many volumes ago, is reacting to all this sword-stealing talk by resonating and breaking the glass of its tank. Nataku asks it if it wants to return to Kamui's side.
And speaking of Kamui, he learns from Nokoru that this chamber was formed using various types of magic. All of the Kamui crew kind of acknowledges this as well. They can, like, kind of feel this magic. And so, for instance, the school's monorail serves as a shield around it by running in the shape of a pentagram, constantly reinforcing this protection spell. And that just made me think of, in, like, the Clamp Campus anime when they have, like, this big dramatic stuff towards the end on the monorail. And I'm like, oh, God, this could have caused great distress later.
I know, I love it.
So Toru, Kamui's mother, met the chairman while the school was first being built, and they actually halted construction so that these aspects could be built into the campus, like, instead of being added later on. So this is just, like, baked into the campus. And Kamui would love to talk to the chairman, as you might imagine, and Nokoru would love that too, but apparently she's gone full recluse since she retired, and I think made him the chairman, and won't see anyone. However, she's passed on the message that seeing her wouldn't help them anyway. Kamui must seek answers elsewhere. And Nokoru also conveys another message from Tokiko, Kamui's aunt. When they seal the sacred sword here, the other sword will also be sealed, which is very good news because that would mean other Kamui, aka Dark Fuma, couldn't use the other sword for who knows what. If he does get the other sword, however, that would be bad. So all this talk of other Kamui reminds our Kamui of what he's gone through and how Superu helped him realize what his goal is, to get Fuma back whatever it takes.
Back to the other sword. It is still reacting. Its resonance seems to reverberate with the power of an earthquake, and Nataku is thinking of Dark Fuma, who they call Papa, an associate with their generic clamp dad-looking not-dad character. Anyway, they take the sword for him while the lab is pretty much destroyed.
Back to Kamui in the chamber, where he stabs the sword into the device, sealing it away until the time it is needed most. The pentagram reacts, not just around the sword, but around the entire campus, including the monorail, which we now know has a role in making the whole campus a protective circle for the sword. And we get a shot of Dark Fuma. He knows it's been sealed. He says, "The world's fate now hangs in the balance. The final battle is about to begin." And he does not look concerned, but rather pleased, maybe even excited.
It is time for Kanoe, who we haven't really had much face time with in a while. She is bragging to Hinata, so, you know, probably in dream space, that she saw the other Kamui coming, back when Fuma walked through Yuto's Kekai in, like, Volume 2, kind of the end of Volume 1. She exposits that he was destined to fill the void as the other Kamui, assuming whatever role first Kamui did not pick. She knows he's going to be hers, and is already coming to her. Hinata protests, saying it's all wrong, and has a line about how Kanoe can't see something. But Kanoe cuts her off to point out that even if she can't see into the future, she can see Hinata's dreams, and that's enough. She knows the two possible futures that hang in the balance, and she will make sure the dream Hinata saw will come true. Meanwhile, Beast has informed Satsuki, and indirectly Yuto, who's just standing in the room still, that their Kamui has arrived. Other Kamui goes to Kanoe, who embraces him, her kind of soft and sexy about it, him stiff and, like, disinterested.
Back to Kamui, who is done sealing the sacred sword. I totally feel like a correspondent. I'm in the Kamui room, you're in the not-Kamui room. It's
fine. Yes, I'm in the other Kamui room. Yes, our other Kamui correspondent, me.
Back to Kamui correspondent Lucy, where Kamui is done sealing the sacred sword and announces he's going to the Diet Building to speak to Hinata and get answers about his mother's fate and his own. Nokoru and the boys, which it sounds like an awesome band that I would totally listen to, assures him that the sword will be safe here. They will protect it until he needs it. And oh my god, Robin, if anyone hurts my clamp boys, I swear to god.
No, right? Also, can we point out that Nokoru is the shortest of the three now, and Suo has grown up to be very large.
Yeah, he got the patented clamp shoulders.
Yes. Speaking of very large, in a panel where his manly shoulders are out of control, Kusanagi is chilling with some adorable birds, being a Disney princess, Jojo, Beefcake, when he sees Nataku, like, doing the X jump through town. He recognizes that they have the sacred sword and follows them. Seishiro has also turned up at the Tokyo Metropolitan Government Building, so both sides are definitely gathering.
Speaking of sides, Hinoto and Kakyo are having a conversation about how they've given up so much to be dream seers. Hinoto can't see or hear, and Kakyo can't even take his own life, the wish that other Kamui will grant for him. Kakyo says they both know how the battle will end, because they've seen it. But Hinoto is trying to defy it to save her own selfish desire. I think this is sort of a continuation of... I think he was kind of throwing some accusations at her at the end of the last volume, and this is...
Yeah.
I'm not sure if this is exactly the same scene, or if they've just, like, come back to talk more.
Yeah, it's, it is actually a little inconsistent.
Yeah,
but okay.
It's fine. So he also reveals that there's a dream she's been keeping from Konoe. So despite what Konoe has said, she's not actually aware of everything Hinoto has seen. And this is, like, some deep, scary shit, gang. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, this is not the point of the story at which we want ambiguity to come in, because all of these things are being decided.
Yeah, and, like, the time has passed when we could not be on Hinoto's side, so it's sort of distressing to now think that she might not be as on board as we might like. So Kakyo says that other Kamui told him that the future was already set, and both he and Hinoto knew that Fuma was destined to be a dragon of Earth, and that Hinoto knew there was no way of stopping it. Hinoto asks, or maybe muses, if there is truly no way to stop the future they see. And Kakyo points out that Kotori, though she never fully came into her powers, saw the future as being undecided in her death dream. Hinoto asks him if he believes that dream, and he turns the question back on her. Does she believe the future can be changed?
Okay, back to Team Earth. Yuto and Satsuki have joined Konoe and met other Kamui. Yuto knows that this isn't the boy he was spying on back when he and Sodata fought in Volume 2. Konoe declares that this is their Kamui, and that they should know this. And indeed, they both respond to him. Like, they can tell there's some part of them that understands that this is true. Beast definitely told Satsuki, but Yuto can, like, feel it. Fuma slash other Kamui sets Kakyo down on Konoe's fucking Geiger throne and introduces him as the dream seer. Konoe recognizes he must be the dream seer who broke into Hinoto's dream. Beast also flings wires into Satsuki to inform her that Kusanagi, Seishiro, and Natsuku are approaching, and other Kamui announces that one of them is bringing him his sacred sword.
Back to Hinoto, who has a cute scene with Saiki, who is worried about her because she looks exhausted. Apparently she can't find rest in sleep because she'll just dream of the future more, which, oh boy, that makes... Oh, so
terrible.
It's horrible. It's like when you keep having bad dreams, so sleep is not even restful. Ugh.
Ugh.
So she asks him if he's ever resented his destiny. He's been working for her for 8 years.
I'd like to point out that this question is asked as a floating word bubble over a borderless panel of exploded clockworks. So often when they discuss destiny as a mechanistic thing, we see the gears and inner workings of a clock. To see one destroyed here is definitely significant, especially since we just went from thinking of Hinoto as being our pillar of truth to knowing that she is compromised.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I hadn't, like, noticed that until you pointed it out, and so he, of course, doesn't see the dire portent of the motifs outside of the panels, and he also doesn't resent his destiny. He feels like his place is by her side, and has a sweet moment, if tinged with sadness. We don't get to go into any deeper, though, because Kamui, with his crew in tow, shows up to ruin the mood. Though instead of being violent, as all of her retainers assume he'll be, he simply kneels in front of Hinoto and, heartbroken, asks if she knows what happened to Fuma. She tells him she does, and she also knows what happened to Kotori. She extends her hand, telling him she will answer his questions in the dream. So we crash through glass, which we're getting those glass shards that they use a lot to kind of transition stuff, to see Hinoto and Kamui floating as if in space with the earth in front of them. Kamui asks what happened to his mother, and Hinoto points down to the earth, taking us to a scene between Kamui's mother, Toru, and Kotori and Fuma's mother, Saya. Toru is trying to convince Saya to leave Togakushi Shrine, but Saya can't be swayed. She's known all along that she lived for Toru and would someday die for her. She reveals that Kotori is already coming into her powers. Earlier that day, she took Saya's hand and asked her not to go away. She's inherited Saya's ability, but stronger. Saya can only see things that have to do with Toru, which is how she was led to her. Toru cries, knowing that Saya will die tomorrow, and Saya says that she will probably be going to hell for having lived a lie with her husband and children, but despite what people might think, she's been happy. Toru says she wishes she had more power so she could change Saya's destiny, but Saya says not even gods can do that. Only she has the power to choose her own future. The next day, we see her sitting with her husband, Kyogo, Kotori and Fuma's dad. The time has come. He tells her that he's always known that she could only love Toru, but he married her anyway, because he loved her with all his heart, even though he knew she would never love him back.
Shades of Rig Veda there, right?
Yeah.
He definitely had a couple like that in Rig Veda.
Yeah. So as she pulls the sword out of herself, he promises to protect it with his life until Kamui comes to claim it. And she bursts into pieces as the sword is born.
Oof.
Oof indeed.
All right. So that's some big stuff. Back to Kamui and Hinoto for a moment, as Kamui realizes that Saya chose to give her life for the sword and for his mother. Hinoto offers to show him more. It will cause him pain, but he knows he needs to see it. Back to the scene of Saya's death, Kyogo takes the sword away, and Kid Huma peers out from around a corner. He's got cold, dead eyes. We're definitely dealing with Dark Huma here, when they were children. Mm-hmm. He picks up his mother's head, and when blood drips down his wrist, he licks it off with a chilling smile. This totally fucks up Kamui, and Hinoto explains that it was at that moment when Fuma started to go down the path of being the other Kamui. Kamui must have noticed some glimmer of this personality, and sure enough, Kamui remembers the moments when Fuma didn't seem like himself or didn't remember conversations over the last few volumes. Hinoto explains that those were all moments when he, real Kamui, was unconsciously trying to decide between being a dragon of heaven or dragon of earth. So, big reveal. And we did look back, and it tracks. Every time Fuma was becoming Dark Fuma, was becoming other Kamui, those are times where Kamui was especially, not just conflicted, but like pushing towards the direction of becoming a Dragon of Heaven, because he was thinking about how much he wanted to protect Kotori and Fuma. Because for him, those are the same thing.
Yeah, that just gave me shivers when they explained that, because of course those were happening at like very, you know, convenient dramatic times, but it did line up with him having this kind of internal struggle, and it was done well in that I, even knowing that, because I've read this before, like even having that somewhere in the back of my mind, it did not quite connect that that's what was happening.
Yeah, and it's a great one of those moments of like, this is their like dualism here, of like, as soon as he becomes one thing, the other one is sort of forced to become this other thing. Mm-hmm. Hinoto recounts how Kamui returned to Tokyo after his mother's death and tried to push away his friends to protect them. When their father was killed, that forced his decision: walk away from them or protect them with his life. It is in such choices, she says, that we make our destinies, determine our fates. That is her having a fit of actually treating fate and destiny as simply a word to describe the effect part of cause and effect, which is pretty impressive for her. Had he walked away, he would have stopped caring about his friends, the earth, and ultimately himself. Love, that was the choice. For we can only love when we choose to protect, she says. By deciding to protect them, he would thus have to protect the earth. By the way, we get cherry blossoms on this page, even though it's mostly been glass shards up until now, which is cool.
Yeah.
And again, like, by the end of this, I will devote some time to talking about how I've been tracking the different motifs throughout the story. Seriously, if anybody else is interested in sharing data with me for that, I would love to talk to people about that. I think it's really interesting.
I love that you're doing that, and it's also making me more aware when I'm reading, to kind of like, I'm not keeping a tally or anything, but like, it makes me more aware of them when they pop up, which is cool.
Yeah, it's really easy when you're reading comics to forget that a person had to actively choose every single thing that's on a page, because sometimes not everything is super deliberate. Sometimes it is kind of just somebody's reserve of imagery that is what they always use to fill a page. Some, you know, like some elements really are simply compositional, but sometimes they're not. And I think with this particular comic, they're definitely more than just compositional elements. Like, they're using it to code things a little bit. It's part of the storytelling from their point of view. And it is so easy to miss that stuff because we focus on the text and on the faces and trying to parse the action. And it's really easy to just not notice that every other aspect of a comic is also human labor and creative and part of the storytelling. And sometimes it'll get into your brain totally subconsciously, and sometimes you really do miss it. Anyway, Kamui asks Hinoto if he could have saved Kotori if he'd walked away. No, she says. Either way, she was destined to die. She lied to him when she said that he could save Kotori if he became a dragon of earth way back in the beginning. Oh,
yeah,
dear.
Oh, dear indeed.
Kamui asks why she lied to him. Was it for the sake of the world? But no, she said, it was for her own reasons. But she won't lie to him again.
which is nice and all, but So now she will show him how his mother died. In Okinawa, Toru's on the phone talking to the chairman. She knows that Kamui will go to Clamp Campus and that there will be two swords, and that the first one will be taken by other Kamui. Which is interesting, because no one seemed to know that as it was happening, but apparently his mom totally did, and the chairman apparently also did. So she asks the chairman to guard the second sword after it is born, until Kamui needs it. As she hangs up the phone, it catches fire, and the fire consumes her arm. As the fire moves to her body, she says that it seems she didn't have enough power after all. Kamui tries to intervene, but of course he can't. This is just a dream, and his mother is already dead. Hinoto explains that Toru died in this way because she was the heir to the Megami clan. She died as a shadow sacrifice. But for what?
Remember?
Yeah.
Remember when we were asking, oh, but who was she dying for? Like, all the way back in the early volumes? Oh my goodness, we're about to get it.
Yeah, so Kamui asks, for what? And we've all been wondering this. Hinoto tells us, it was for the Earth itself. And Toru says that she's sorry to be leaving Kamui to face his cruel fate alone, and that he must become stronger, strong enough to choose his future. Memory Kamui joins the scene in time for Toru to tell him to go to Tokyo, where his destiny awaits. And she burns up, saying Saya's name.
Now, Kamui wants to know more about this whole dying for the Earth thing. So, Hinoto explains that Toru took on the suffering of the Earth, the damage that leads to global warming, cutting down trees, poisoning the land, and spewing toxic gases into the air. Each year gets hotter. Unfortunately, Toru could only take so much, and her power could never be enough. So, yeah, she burned to death as a shadow sacrifice for global warming. Mm-hmm. Like, they do literally tell you that.
Yeah.
Kamui asks if that was why she was burned to death. But then the dream is taken over by Kakyo. He says, the world cries out for change. Although the original uses the verb wishes, not cries out for. Mm. So, but similar like, amount of drama there,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, that's interesting, though.
Yeah, and then he introduces himself to Kamui, who recognizes his name from Kotori's painful babbling towards the end. Kakyo tells him that he and other Kamui look identical to him, and shows us the crystal cross that he used to represent Kamui when he was talking to Kotori. He lays it all out. If the Seven Seals win, humanity will survive, but Tokyo and the entire Earth will suffer from desertification as global warming destroys the planet's ecosystems. If the Seven Angels win, all of mankind's structures will be destroyed and humanity will fall, but the Earth will continue on. He asks which of these futures seem more beautiful to Kamui, showing him a vision of Tokyo overtaken by jungle and Tokyo standing over a desert. He goes on to explain at the current rate the Earth will die because mankind is slowly killing it, and he asks if Kamui still wishes for the world to be unchanged, which is what the Dragons of the Heaven are, like, that is what they're fighting for, is the status quo, even knowing where it will lead. Kamui says the world is more than the Earth alone, it is humanity, the people he loves. If those people aren't there, the whole world might as well be gone too. Kakyo seems to be moved by this, although we don't know exactly how, like in which direction he is moved. Is he horrified? Is he touched? We don't quite know. He says something about how the battle must end, and he's about to tell Kamui something, but Hinoto breaks through his dream.
Yeah, and Kamui wakes up back in the Diet Building basement, with everyone looking down at him in concern. He explains to them about Kakyo and how he might have made a terrible mistake. The world will be destroyed one day. But he made his choice, and he's going to get Fuma back. Other Kamui seems to hear this, and we get a cool two-page spread with all the angels looking at the reader in the position of Fuma, and all the seals looking at the reader in the position of Kamui. We also get some lovely pages after that. A double-page spread showing the two of them back-to-back with their respective wings, strewn with the beads we associate with Kotori and a bit with Hokuto. Then of the Earth overlaid with feathers, and then finally the two Kamuis with their hands encircling the Earth. The final page says, the Earth's final saga has begun.
All right, and this is the end of the volume, but we do have a little Adachi side stories. We've been getting these little backstories each time. This one is finally Adachi's, and oh boy, guys. So, tiny, adorable Adachi is dressed in dirty clothes, watching crows eat a discarded bento. A lady in a kimono asks what she's doing, and she says she's trying to decide if she should eat it or not. The lady asks why, and Adachi says she's wondering what point there is to life if you have to eat garbage to survive. The lady asks her name, and Adachi explains that her mother died 3 months ago. Her mother told her she had to keep living even without her, but she's trying to decide if living like this is worth it. She wants to obey her mother, but alive or dead, she's still alone. Well, the lady says that she's come to get her and takes her to Ise's shrine. Cleaned up and looking much better, Adachi's refusing to eat. She hasn't decided if she wants to live or not. When the lady asks about her mother, Adachi says that she was always afraid. She thought someone was going to come take Adachi away and would barely leave her side, so they never had much money. But she was good to her. The lady explains that Adachi's mother used to be a priestess at the Ise shrine until she got pregnant. She knew Adachi's fate was to be a dragon of heaven, so she ran away to protect her. How can a girl be a dragon? Tiny Adachi asks. The woman, Kaede, who is also a Miko of Ise shrine, asks her back, how can a girl be alone with no friends or family? She wonders if that is a kind of death, being all alone. The lady goes on to say that now Adachi will meet many people in her life, friends, enemies, and some people who will love her very, very much. She explains that they were looking for her and her mother and just didn't make it in time. But if Adachi died, it would break her heart. Adachi asks if she really would be sad if she died, and the lady says yes. Adachi hugs her furiously and turns to eat.
Oh.
And I think this is a moment, as we are struggling with this worldwide pandemic, reach out to anyone you know who might be really isolated right now.
Yeah.
Some people really enjoy being independent and living alone, but that doesn't mean they don't want a reminder that people care about them.
Yeah, I think even introverts are having trouble right now, and like, even if you kind of prefer that, this is still a weird time, and it's worth kind of like touching each other. It's worth kind of reaching out.
All right. What a place for that volume to end.
Yeah.
So we've got some talking points for this episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it feels like we're finally getting explanations, which is nice, even though some of the explanations are everything you thought was right is wrong.
Yes. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, so I don't know. In this volume, a few things just kind of popped out at me, and I think we kind of talked about some of them as we did the summary, but unrequited love came up a bit. There obviously wasn't unrequited love between Toru and Saya. We get that they were very much both loving each other, but between Saya
and Kyogo, yeah.
Yeah, there was definitely this kind of bittersweet thing where he loved her all along, even though he knew that she couldn't love him back. And it was so touching, especially after she just said she thought she was going to hell because she'd been living a lie. Like, she hadn't actually been living a lie, it turns out. Like, he was just also loving her, and
yeah, that no one was being hurt, and that maybe the worst thing was that they couldn't all be upfront about it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which, I mean, I feel that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have a note here about power, and I remember that when we watched the X movie, there was a line that his mother had about power and being strong enough to change your fate, and how different that sounded mm-hmm. in a movie that had a little bit more male gaze than in this comic, which is just doesn't have that.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting because, like, yeah, in this volume, we can kind of see that, like, oh, his mother was actually preoccupied by the fact that she didn't have enough power, enough, like, physical magical power or psychic power or whatever it is, like mystical strength to do what she wanted to do, right? That she felt disempowered, that she felt like she just wasn't good enough because she couldn't save the Earth, she couldn't save Saya, and she couldn't save Kamui. Like, that he was going to be stuck dealing with all of this, and that the woman she loved most in the world was going to die for her, and she couldn't stop that, but that also her own death on behalf of the Earth wouldn't even save the Earth. Like, it wouldn't even be enough, that, like, she was just going to burn up as this sort of sacrifice that won't even accomplish anything.
Yeah, yeah.
And God.
In the movie, it just felt kind of, I don't know, it didn't have a whole lot of context. And then, which doesn't necessarily mean it was wrong in the movie, but it hit so much harder when we got to this in the manga because it was accompanied with all these scenes with Saya. And we understand more what she meant by power. Like, not necessarily, like, wealth and, you know, the power of war and stuff, but more just, like, almost spiritual power or something. Like, it just made more sense in hell. And I thought it was interesting how different I felt reading that scene from seeing the kind of comparable scene in the movie. It was just kind of an interesting difference there.
And interesting how Saya's belief about the power to change your own destiny definitely flies in the face of so many of the other characters' view of Destiny, but it is very much more like Kotori's "the future is yet undecided"
line. And it's the first time we've seen someone who feels a bit more like a authority figure, I guess, because it is a parent and it is kind of from the past and maybe they knew more things. You know, a character that felt like they know more about what's going on, even though she admits that she could only really see, you know, things related to Toru and only really enough to kind of like get her to her and, you know, save her life, I guess, in the taking her place as the sword thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was the first time we've seen like an authority figure like that saying something that kind of lines up with what Kotori has been saying from her kind of like very lower position of power, I guess, in the story. And that just seemed nice to have like a...
Yeah, reinforcement there.
All right. And then Hinata's lies felt really... Oh, I mean, it's a big part. We kind of can't not talk about it.
Yeah. Well, and we don't know everything yet, too. So the worst part is that we know there is still something that this volume, like, multiple times, she is, like, someone has interrupted so that we couldn't figure out this other piece of missing info, mm-hmm. which is, why did she do it? What is the future she wants? What is her motivation to be lying and manipulating things? Because at this point, we can't not know that she manipulated Kamui. And remember how in the very beginning, we noticed that we were like, that was actually a horrible way to manipulate him, right? That, like, show him his childhood best friend dying horribly and then say, join me to save her. Mm-hmm. Like, that is super manipulative. And now we're like, oh yeah, no, it was super manipulative.
Yeah.
Every part of it was manipulative.
Yeah. And I mean, this felt kind of like a very big deal when I first read it. Like, I didn't really remember it happening, you know, when we were reading the early volumes, but it didn't kind of feel as much of a surprise when it got revealed at the end of like the last volume that she had, you know, been lying about these things. And obviously with Kotori's death, like, you know, the thing she promised did not happen. But it felt like such a big deal when I read this as a teen, because it just, I think partially because now we're sort of at the point where I think I was reading as the volumes came out in English, and we didn't yet have, like, we had the movie, but we didn't yet have the anime, so we didn't know what happened from here on out. So it was very like...
Yeah. It was like new information that was really shocking. Yeah. Like, it felt like an important pivot point in the story.
Yeah, and you're right. We still don't even know what the lies are, or really what even one of the alternatives is. Like, we gather that from what Kakyo is saying, we probably wouldn't like the outcome that they've seen, because obviously she's trying to change it, but we don't know exactly what that is. Maybe that outcome means that, like, something we would actually be totally on board with happens, but it goes against things Hinata wants. Like, we don't really know what any of the options are still.
Yeah. Speaking of options, I can't not, like, we're going to come back to this basically every volume for the rest of X. We got to talk about the choice that Kamui was given, mm-hmm. because it actually does not make sense. And I mean, does not make sense as written at all. Like, it just doesn't. And I do not know whether that is because, as we're saying, we're missing a piece of information because this is intentionally manipulative on behalf of the characters in the text, or whether this doesn't make sense because, as I've sort of been assuming from the very beginning of this, this choice is coming out of a really misguided 90s understanding of environmentalism and Gaia theory and apocalyptic bullshit that is, like, not very grounded and is kind of, like, messy. So
yeah,
I'm gonna try to...
Yeah. There's kind of just, like, a false dichotomy here, and I'll let you talk
really
about
is.
But yeah.
Yeah, like, so here's the problem. The most, like, succinct way of describing the choice that he's given, and what, how they often describe it is, you're fighting for humanity or for the Earth, okay? Which is, like, implies that one of these futures, humans survive, and in one of them, the Earth survives. But in actual physical reality, humans who are part of nature are not separate from nature, which is one of those things that comes out of a lot of, like, religious understandings of humans versus the world they live in, but is not physically, scientifically a thing. Like, we are 100% natural creatures who mm-hmm. also evolved on this planet to be a part of nature. Like, yeah. We are not separate. We actually can't live without the Earth other than in space, which they have not brought up anything about people escaping into space. Like, that has not come up in this story. So there is no sense that that could be what they're talking about. Like, if the Earth actually does, like, and by the Earth, we mean the ecosystems, the biosphere, right? With a non-functioning biosphere, humans also cannot function. We eat food that is grown in the ground. Mm-hmm. Like, we need drink water and breathe air that has to be a certain, like, composition or we will die. So, you actually can't have this dichotomy of yes, humans, but no Earth, or yes, Earth, but no humans. Like, you could definitely have an Earth with no humans. It won't look the same, and it's not necessarily what the Earth wants. The Earth doesn't care what creatures live on it. Like, even in Gaia theory, there's a little bit of, we are also part of the Earth, and to say that we are not is, like, to deeply misunderstand actual nature and the way that biospheres really work. It's really wild. But also, I remember, like, we were raised in a super hippie town, and I remember that being kind of the way, especially in the 90s, everybody talked about everything, as though we were, like, as though human beings were so separate. And you're like, well, it's not actually human beings. Like, it is not our needing to eat and live in shelters that is causing global warming. It is capitalism, where you are, like, strip mining and destroying swaths of the rainforest just so that you can, like, raise cattle to feed people very specific food that is also wasted on a level that is ridiculous. Like, none of this, like, none of that is what humans do. That is what we, like, humans are doing it. It is not a necessary actual part of humanity. It is a system that can be stopped and that humans could stop doing with some help. It would also stop humans from killing other humans. So it's like, it's really this false dichotomy of saying, well, it's humans' fault. The problem that I have with this way of viewing it is that this is the kind of philosophy and ideology that led to the Malthusian overpopulation myth, which is a myth, and was 100% used to prop up genocide. Mm-hmm. It was absolutely something used to let the Western world subjugate and destroy what they would call the Third mm-hmm. World. It sucks, and it's one of those things that we were told this as though it were gospel truth as children. It turns out it isn't. Nothing, like, it just isn't. It has nothing to do with that. We could feed everybody so easily, you know? Like none of these are, like, none of these are a thing. It's 100% just a way to blame the Earth's problems on the poorest people in the world when they're all being caused by the richest people in the world. And because that's kind of an issue with this dichotomy, like, with this choice, it does not make sense. The choice is total garbage. And again, I don't know whether that is because, hey, she started writing this when she was in eighth grade, and it is a very childlike understanding of save humanity or save the Earth, or whether we are kind of missing that the choice is actually, you know, keep the status quo, and humans will eventually cause a collapse of the biosphere, or destroy humans, and then the biosphere is, like, remains. That one is way harder to choose Kamui's side. It's way easier to say, yeah, no, if you could just eliminate humans and everything would be fine, that's great. But both of those definitely also forget that, like, the sun will eventually burn out. You know, like, heat death of the universe will happen. Like, yeah. Like, are we not worrying about preserving the species on Earth through, like, taking them to another planet via space travel? Like, is that something that we don't think humans can do? Like, is it okay if the sun does it, but not okay if we do it? Like, there's definitely some weird morality in here that is a little bit of, like, if it's the first time you've ever considered that human beings are capable of destroying nature, or if you view one tree's life and all of the trees of the rainforest that are being, you know, cut down for McDonald's, like, if you see those things as being completely equal because you're coming at it from a completely animistic point of view, like, I can understand that that gets a little muddy, but I also think that's really shitty. Like, I think that's a really, like, shitty way of focusing on, like, trying to extrapolate, like, your very personal, like, I love this tree that my neighbor cut down, and it makes me feel like humans are cruel to nature. And you're like, no, but you're neighbor also planted a lot of plants, and that tree also was shading ground where plants can't grow. Like, you get to some really weird morality of, like, I don't know, like, what, like, where do you, like, there is no end to it, right? At some point, you're going to find something else that is just as destructive, and what do you do with that, right? Like, I think it's really interesting also to note that any story where you find that you're fighting on the side of the status quo feels a little weird to me. Because, like, the world does need to be changed, but the fact that they're totally focused on the change needing to be on behalf of ecosystems, which didn't collapse by the year 2000, they didn't. I mean, some do, and it happens all the time, and it's terrible, but they also have collapsed many times throughout history, and, like, I am not a climate change denier at all. It is super terrible, but it is also something that humans can fix. Like, we can do something about this. And the fact that nowhere in the story do they ever talk about humans needing to be responsible for fixing human problems really weirds me out, because that is, like, you have people with superpowers. Why are we totally preoccupied with these environmental issues and not at all preoccupied with how we could use our powers to fix them?
Yeah.
It is totally short-sighted and wild to me. And, like, I'm so sorry, because this is, like, one of my favorite comics of all time, but this choice doesn't work. Emotionally, it does, right? If the choice is save humans or save the Earth, like, I get that that is supposed to make sense to people, but it does not wash. And it super doesn't wash when you realize that all of these people could be doing something more. Like, why can't Hinoto use her political influence to sway people to protect the environment? Can't the Dreamseers figure out who's planning to do actual evil and stop them? Can't Kamui stop bombs from being dropped or rainforests from being bulldozed or use psychic powers to clean up an oil spill or remove toxins from the water table of Detroit, Michigan? Like, couldn't you use your powers to actually solve these problems? But if you decide that it's all a mechanistic fate destiny thing, then you can't. However, I have said all of this. This is my rant. I'm sorry you're going to hear it again. I'm so sorry. I'll try to make sure it's different next time. But all that being said, what do you and I know, Lucy, about Clamp's beliefs about destiny?
If memory serves, they don't believe in it.
Yeah. So there's something interesting where I'm sitting here talking about, like, this really short-sighted, like, bad choice. And I'm like, yeah, but, like, the whole point of the story is that maybe there is really a third way.
Yeah.
like the whole point of the story here is that he is being kind of lied to and manipulated. And I'm like, okay, I think that's kind of interesting, especially for all of us, because when we were kids, I know we constantly debated this, and we were, quite a few of our friend group were very like, yeah, dragons of the earth all the way, like, you gotta save the earth. And I'm really, like, I'm totally sympathetic to that. Like, duh, the Earth is beautiful and amazing and doesn't deserve to be destroyed by people being shitty, but it also is where I keep all my stuff, and I also really love humans, and I think humans are a part of the Earth. So it's very much, like, it's a weird, messy debate, but it's interesting how, like, hey, if they don't believe in destiny and it is destiny that's going to do this, maybe they're also trying to get you to think a little bit about these options and how much they are truly predetermined.
Yeah, it does seem a little frustrating that in this volume, at least, it feels like the choice is just action or inaction. But the action is a very specific one. And like you said, it doesn't really make sense that they couldn't just, like, do actions that preserve both humanity and the Earth that humanity needs to live. Like, if this happens now or in the next whatever 3 years or something, the humans are not going to be able to live on that, you know, like, sandy crazy world in which there's, like, only Tokyo Tower or whatever. Like,
no, there's nothing to eat, you can't breathe and drink, like, you can't survive without that
stuff. And maybe it's meant to be that they're, like, picking a path that will be the eventual result, not like an immediate action. Like, they are deciding which direction, I guess, humanity will go, either, like, dying out so the Earth can reclaim itself, or destroying the Earth and then, I guess, dying out. But I agree, it doesn't really feel like, I got it when I was a teenager, like, I get where they're coming from on this, like, emotional and kind of, like,
I think it really hits kids. Like, I think but that's the problem, is I think it's a really childish view on it.
Yeah. I feel like it's, we actually see some of this happening now where people are going really like, humans are the plague on the earth. And it's like, no, no, we need to actually just address the problems we're causing and like maintain.
Yeah, you can stop the people who are causing those problems without killing like swaths of people in countries that whose names you can't remember because you don't actually know anything about this real actual planet and only scream about the one issue you heard about today. Like, oh
yeah, or actually take steps to, for instance, contain a pandemic as opposed to just throwing up your hands and saying there's no good, we have to maintain the economy, or, you know, completely shutting everything down and hoping people just like die quietly, I guess. Like there's not they're creating a binary that doesn't exist and is not helpful. And I mean, obviously they're not creating it, but like this, they are definitely utilizing a false dichotomy. And again, I don't know that that was like, that may be very intentional. Like that might be the point, because like you were saying, like Kotori and now Saya both are kind of falling on the side of there's another way here, guys. And they feel like we should be believing them. Like their opinions are given a lot of weight, not just in like the way the story is written and drawn and stuff, but also like by the other characters. Like Kakyo seems kind of on board.
Yeah, there is this sense of like self-fulfilling prophecy being the only real prophecy here, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays out too. I need to not stargaze, but I do think that that is worth keeping in mind as we move forward. Like, I could not have my rant about how this is like an incredibly shallow version of environmentalism, but also like I do remember being very affected by it when I was younger and didn't understand things better and had been very like falsely like led to certain conclusions that now seem obviously racist and bullshit. Those were things that were just taught to us like they were gospel at one point in time, and I do remember the kinds of conversations that we had in the 90s. Like, I do remember what it was like to grow up in that period and to have that be the kind of discussion and to have that be revolutionary at the time. So, like, I understand where this is coming from, but...
Yeah, but the conversation...
It will be interesting to see where it goes.
Yeah, the conversation has evolved since then and needs to continue to evolve if we actually want to solve this kind of real problem.
Yeah. Because I do think we can solve it, but we have to solve it, and we can't solve it through inaction, but you also don't solve it by just murdering everybody. Yeah. Sorry.
So on that note, next week, well, next episode, you know how this all works, we are going to be reading more X, and then more X, and then more X, and then more X, so keep reading X, guys.
It'll be fine. You can follow us on Twitter and Tumblr at ClampCastPod, on Facebook as ClampCast in Wonderland, and on our website, ClampCastInWonderland.com. You can also join our Patreon, where we will be releasing bonus episodes about other classic anime and possibly other things. I'm excited. I think we're going to do a Rumiko Takahashi short story soon.
We're definitely not doing Moto Hagio again for a while.
Yes, we've done two, and we'll take a nice long break. I could just do it forever, but then that would be neglecting everyone else I love, and that's just terrible. All right, so thank you for coming with us on our journey through Clamp's Wonderland.
Until next time, remember that everything will be all right.
And try not to lose an eye.